KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. One of civilization's most primal stories, the ancient biblical tale of Adam and Eve, continues to shape Western culture to this day. Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Harvard Humanities professor Stephen Greenblatt will join us in studio to discuss the biblical origin story and his new book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. And that's next, after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Many of us think we know the biblical story of Adam and Eve and its themes of original sin, temptation, and exile, but the story has a complicated history, beginning as a Babylonian creation myth and later taking on literal meaning for medieval and Renaissance Catholics. In his new book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, award-winning Harvard University humanities professor Stephen Greenblatt excavates the origins and retellings of the ancient tale to illustrate how it continues to shape Western culture. Stephen Greenblatt won a Pulitzer Prize for Swerve, How the World Became Modern, and we welcome Stephen Greenblatt back to Forum. Good to have you.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Miss you, as I know people at Berkeley do, but you're happy at Harvard.
I am happy, though if you've lived as I did for a better part of a quarter of a century in Berkeley, you know how beautiful, wonderful it is, so it's a pleasure to be back in the Bay Area.
How long are you here for?
Till this afternoon.
Well, Berkeley is Eden for many places, and excuse me, for many people who are living in many places, especially a kind of prelapsarian memory of Berkeley during those years of ferment and everything. But let's go right to the heart of your book, which gets into the major Abrahamic story of Adam and Eve. And the story is so deep in our culture and so deep in our ur-consciousness and all the rest of it. But I want to go back a little bit, as you do, to something that we learned from your book about. There are a lot of myths that go back to Babylonian captivity. Gilgamesh myth, probably the best-known one, which was really the Noah story. But there was also a kind of pre-creation story that preceded Adam and Eve. And you make a good deal out of how this – well, in fact, I inferred as a reader how the world would have changed so much if that had been adopted as opposed to Adam and Eve.
Of course, counterfactuals are strange games, so we don't know really what would have happened had we had a different origin story. What we do know is that virtually all cultures – ask themselves, how did we get here? Where are we from? What determined the way we are? And the peoples of Mesopotamia had competing versions of this story, and the Hebrews had their own, they may have had their own floating around for a long time, but they wrote it down after they had had a century of having to listen as slaves in Babylonia, exiles, having to listen to the Mesopotamian story, which, as you say, simultaneously resembles and differs from the one that the Hebrews wrote down, had a different god for starters, Marduk or Apsu, but then it also had had a different structure. There was a garden. Humans were created to work in the garden in the Mesopotamian story, but really work in the garden, dig irrigation ditches, do the scut work that the junior gods didn't want to do. And in the Mesopotamian story, the problem was that humans didn't do anything wrong. They didn't transgress. They just were noisy. They made an incredible racket, especially the babies made a racket. And so the god couldn't sleep in the afternoon because the Mesopotamian god, like the Hebrew god, wanted rest. But the Hebrew god apparently took his rest without worrying about squalling babies. The Mesopotamian god couldn't sleep. And so he created, in effect, infant mortality, the death of women and so forth and so on, and childbirth, in order to reduce the population. That's a very different account of why we suffer from the ones that the Hebrews came up with, which was that we did something wrong at the beginning of it all.
Well, it gets us into original sin, and it gets you into Augustine, really.
Well, the Hebrews didn't settle on the idea of original sin. This was,
it's more a Christian notion.
A Christian idea. Yeah. And in fact, the Christians embraced the Adam and Eve story in a way that the Hebrews, though they put the story at the beginning of their Torah, for Jews, really, the Abraham and Isaac story is at the center of identity. As for the Muslims, the story of Abraham and Ishmael is at the center. But because St. Paul said that Jesus was the new Adam, it seemed tremendously important for Christians to understand who on earth the old Adam was. And this was a commitment to understand the story that flowered most powerfully in the 5th century with the remarkable Bishop of North Africa, St. Augustine, who was obsessed with this story and who did, in fact, come up with this extraordinarily potent and disturbing notion of original sin that we carry just from the moment of our conception and birth.
And in fact, when one thinks of, and you do, you know, your usual sort of, I'm hesitant to use the word deconstruction, but it is a kind of deconstruction, not only of Augustine, but also of Milton in terms of their historicity, in terms of their personal lives, and ways that are really very enlightening and yet take us into a whole recognition of just how powerful and how shaping and evolving this Adam and Eve story was. I want to, in fact, sort of focus for a moment on Augustine. I'm thinking about, you know, to Carthage, burning, because his own lust plays a central role in this, and certainly his interpretation of the story has a great deal to do with sexuality and transgression and the fall and these kinds of things that are usually identified in a kind of, shall we say, Calvinistic view of Christianity or something along those lines. And yet, can't help thinking, you mentioned St. Paul. I mean, he's a real force here in many ways toward what Augustine came up with. And Augustine is often seen as, well, also a champion of good and the human heart and love and all of these kinds of things.
Of course he is. He speaks about love and the human heart and the universal nature of both of sin, but also the possibility, at least through the belief in Christ, of redemption. But Augustine was profoundly disturbed by our inevitable sinful failings as human beings, inevitable because of what happened, he thought, in the garden. That wasn't a notion that was by any means universal among the Jews or among early Christians, but for St. Augustine, who we are, the fact that there's something evidently wrong with us as a species was the inheritance from something that was done at the beginning of time and that was transmitted sexually. For St. Augustine, evil is a sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah, I love that line of yours. Then jump ahead to the 4th century and to a name that many people don't recognize, a 4th century monk by the name of Jerome, who kind of laid the blame on Eve. And thus we have, I dare use the word, seminal misogyny, or the way we've come to have it in Western civilization so dominant, even though you also give us this other figure, this wonderful Italian nun who spent a great deal of time in her nunnery, or in her convent, I should say, lest anybody get confused from Hamlet. There's that reality of just how much the Adam and Eve story has affected, you know, notions of women, notions of evil, Satan in the garden,
yes,
and also our sense of who we are and what we are.
Well, I think there probably will be disagreement among our listeners and among readers about this. I believe that there is nothing inherently, strictly misogynistic in the story. The story,
the temptress of Eve and all that?
She is the first to eat the fruit, but of course she is tempted by the serpent. Adam doesn't have the conversation with the serpent. She does, whoever the serpent is. There were early rabbinical speculations about why she has to face the serpent alone. Some rabbis thought that perhaps they had made love and Adam was napping in the afternoon, and that's why she was there. Others thought that Adam might be taking a tour of paradise, of Eden, and looking around, and therefore wasn't with her. In any case, she is the one who speaks to the serpent. And the very early interpretations of the story, in fact, the earliest that we know, from 2,000 years ago, say that she's the hero of the story. Why? Because she chose knowledge over an injunction against knowledge. The knowledge of the difference between good and evil must be a good thing, many people thought. So, in other words, there is, as you say, of course, a long and miserable misogynistic tradition that goes on and traces itself back to an interpretation of the story, but it's not the only interpretation that's possible.
You know, speaking of interpretations, I know you know this poem by Ted Hughes about the serpent eating Eve after Eve eats Adam.
Yes, and I also know, of course, the notion that God should have told Adam and Eve that they could eat the serpent, but of course he didn't.
We're talking with Stephen Greenblatt, and Stephen Greenblatt's new book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, not to be associated necessarily with the fall from Eden and all that prelapsarian stuff, but the rise and fall of the story, though it's still very much in our cultural DNA.
It is. The story has, still very powerful adherence. Some 40% of Americans profess to believe in the literal truth of this story. The fact that 60% of Americans don't is itself the fall toward which I gesture. That is to say, there was a time in which virtually all if you had a poll, virtually everyone would have paid at least official homage to the idea that this was our origin. Now it's post-Darwin shrunk, but it remains extremely potent.
I hope we can get to Darwin, because he plays a central role, of course, in your book, and still does in our lives and how we see ourselves. But let's get back to the interpretations of Adam and Eve. I mean, Milton sets things on a whole different course, doesn't he?
He does. Milton comes in the wake of a thousand-year effort after Augustine made a crucial decision, which is that we need, Augustine said, to understand this story literally. It's not an allegory. It's not a philosophical parable to which fancy intellectuals can give complex explanations. It's the truth. And Augustine said this for Augustine, who was himself a sophisticated intellectual, said this for reasons that were deep in his body and soul and deep in his beliefs. But he set the world, the Christian world especially, on course to believing that Adam and Eve were real. And it was Milton, and more broadly speaking, it was the Renaissance, the world of Michelangelo, of Rembrandt, of Dürer, of Titian, the world that gave Adam and Eve the bodies that we understand them to have, and also in the case of Milton, gave them a marriage, a relationship, a life. And the trouble is that the more real they become, the more disturbing the problems that are inherent in the story become. There are deep, deep dilemmas in the story from the beginning. And Milton heroically grappled with those dilemmas. How can you tell people to obey an injunction not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil if knowing good and evil would be the only way in which you could obey such an injunction? How can you warn people about the possibility of death if they've lived in a world without death and couldn't possibly understand what death is? And so forth. These problems are not modern perceptions having to do with skeptics. They're ancient perceptions about the problems built into the story.
The problems also, from your analysis, have to do with perhaps some of Milton's own problems, just like they did with Augustine.
But that's true of everybody, Michael, and you and me and anyone else who reads the story. One of the things that's magnificent about this weird, tiny little fable that's had such a long life in our culture is that to grapple with it means to bring yourself, you, me, all of ourselves.
That's what stories do, don't they? I mean, we project ourselves into stories. Yeah?
Story. This is a story that begins with the notion of ha'adama, the human. And insofar as we're human, we bring ourselves to this story and think about our own relationship to it. That's why every third New Yorker cartoon shows a little sketch of a naked man and woman and makes a joke about this, because we're always involved.
The power of the story is one that just encompasses not only exile and transgression and all of these things that are so human, seeking knowledge and the dangers of seeking knowledge, but also shame. And you see, you know, you get into a lot of the art, a lot of it's really Christian art, and really hits home that idea of shame.
Indeed, there was a transformation, of course, in Christian art. The earliest Christian art, which was created at the time in which the Greek and Roman pagans were still depicting naked gods and goddesses, and for that matter, naked athletes at the gym. And then Christians increasingly represent humans bent over in abjection and shame, because the Bible says that Adam and Eve's eyes were opened, they saw they were naked, and they were ashamed, and they covered themselves. And what happened after 1492 was that Europeans looked around and wondered, how is it possible that we're encountering so many people who don't seem to have got the word, which was that all human beings are supposed to be ashamed of their nakedness? Because they encountered in the Caribbean millions of people who were not covering themselves in a way that Europeans thought everyone needs to cover themselves by virtue of who they are as human beings.
There's a writer by the name of Bruce Bauer who writes what I take as a very ad hominem and kind of character assassination of Stephen Greenblatt in The New Criterion. But he says something that locally has some interest, and that is that he takes the argument that you were shaped at Berkeley, kind of implying that there's a paganism in you, that maybe you're projecting some of that onto this story, the ideals of radicalism and paganism that may be associated, and anti-Christianity that may be associated in some people's minds with Berkeley.
Well, I plead guilty to having lived and taught in Berkeley for more than a quarter of a century. If that is a sure sign of wickedness, then I'm among the wicked. But paganism, anti-Christianity, these aren't terms that are actually ones that I'm willing to cop to. I am, for better or worse, not a pagan. And this is a book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, that's deeply about the central beliefs for Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And it is written with a combination of wonder and respect, but also, of course, of skepticism. If you are asking me, do I believe in the literal truth of the story of Adam and Eve, the answer is no. But I wouldn't have written this book if I thought that the story was not then and now immensely powerful and good to think with. I believe in the power of literature. And I believe in my heart, I might as well confess to you and to your listeners, I believe that literature, the human imagination, is ultimately, but I have to stress ultimately, on the side of human enlightenment, not finally on the side of dogmatic piety. If that's wicked, I'm wicked.
Well, I'm also thinking, when you're talking about the power of literature, the power of just a story like Adam and Eve that it's had on civilization and on the three major religions, because that's really at the heart of your book. And when you think about that power, it's hard not to think also about the power of science. I remember Richard Dawkins saying that his whole worldview changed when he discovered Darwin. And in a sense, you're talking about a worldview that changed completely where Adam and Eve was concerned because of Darwin, too.
What's strange, Michael, is that of course, Darwin did change the landscape profoundly and as far as we can tell, forever. But I wrote this book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve, after writing a book about Lucretius and Epicureanism. And the point of which, a book called The Swerve, is that already 2,500 years ago, there was a very sophisticated, quite elaborate scientific and philosophical theory that said that the world consists of atoms and emptiness and nothing else, that we are a species that evolved along with other species, that we're not forever, that the world is not about us, that the gods are not following our moral choices, that we need to make them on our own. And the question is why that theory, which had a life and circulation 2,500 years ago, why that theory went underground and didn't return, in effect, until the 19th century, until Charles Darwin. And the answer really lies in the story of Adam and Eve and everything around the story of Adam and Eve in this alternative account of the world. So when Darwin comes along in the wake of Lyell's geology, in the wake of a nascent understanding that the world is infinitely older than the Jews and the Christians and Muslims had believed, that it doesn't go back to 4004 BC, but goes back millions, billions of years. And when Darwin formulated the principles of the origin of the species, what came back were notions that had been in some nascent form already around 2,500 years ago, but notions that are incompatible with the literal belief in Adam and Eve.
It's fascinating to read in your book how people try to circumvent some of that literal and scientific notion. There's a man by the name of Richard Goss who, like Darwin, was a naturalist, and I think one of the first aquariums that he built.
He was great. Philip Goss was a great naturalist, but also a deeply pious man. And he struggled with this idea of what to do. He's writing in the wake of the great transformation of understanding of the universe in the 19th century. He struggled with what to do with the fossil evidence, with paleological evidence, with how clear it is that there are things that contradict the Bible's account. And what he thought, basically, was that God
went to the belly button, right?
had planted these ideas in the world, even though they weren't true, just as he thought that God must have put a belly button in Adam and Eve because they look better with a belly button, even though they didn't need one from the fact that they weren't born from human parents.
That's, in fact, reminds me of Bertrand Russell's theory that, you know, the world could have been created like an instant ago, right? Everything, records, memory, consciousness, and so on.
Yes, but go that way, and we enter a kind of mad zone. And when Philip Goss published this account in a work called Omphalos, people realized, I think they laughed at him, but I think in laughing at him, they realized that you couldn't try to save religious belief by thinking God is trying to trick you by planting dinosaur bones
and sedimentary rocks. Yeah, and all
exactly.
You take us, though, ultimately to Uganda and to kind of a chimp paradise, although there are lots of Jane Goodall now has been talking. Actually, she recently compared our president to chimps and said, you know, he has that same kind of behavior. But there's a lot. This is reminded me of a James Dickey poem, Animal Heaven, or Heaven of Animals. I'm blank on the right title. But there is a sense that, you know, there's something Edenic about the way animals live as opposed to the way human beings live and have to see things in fall and transgression and exile and all the rest.
I wanted to see for myself, Michael, with my own eyes, what our origin account actually looks like, as it were, in the flesh. And we think that the closest thing we can see to what scientists call the last common ancestor, that is to say, the creature who lived on the earth before we separated out from the other primates, the closest we can see are chimpanzees.
They're the closest in DNA to us, yeah.
And they are very close in DNA to us. So I went to Western Uganda and I had a remarkable time and observing chimpanzees. And it's true that, in effect, what we see, I don't know if we would call it Edenic or paradisal, but what we see are creatures who are like us, but live with some of the principles, at least, that the author of the Genesis story intuited. They live without a knowledge of good and evil, and they live without an awareness of death.
They can be pretty vicious and warlike, too, though.
That's true.
Talking to Stephen Greenblatt, and we invite you to join this conversation. Thoughts about Adam and Eve, thoughts about Stephen Greenblatt's work. I want to ask him about something else when we come back. I just read a piece of his about Shylock, so we'll get into who knows what. But in the meantime, we'd like to hear from you. You can join the conversation with any questions or comments. Our toll-free number is available. Number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us now at that toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. You might want to reflect on Adam and Eve, because that's what we're doing. And has it influenced you? Has it certainly had impact on your life? Probably. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're speaking this hour with Harvard University Humanities Professor Stephen Greenblatt about his new book, The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. And we're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith. Again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I mentioned I read your piece about Shylock and really got me thinking, and it was mentioned just accused sometimes of name-dropping, so I'm overly hyper-conscious of that, but this sounds like a name-drop, I'm sorry, but I have a friend who's a filmmaker, local, known to many people here, named Phil Kaufman, and I just saw him the other night, and he said, what is the origin of Shylock? I guess there's a new book that says there's some character who he's modeled on. I always thought of him as the stage stencil villain, you know, of the anti-Semitic portrait, but Phil sent me something that says there's a whole book about somebody he was actually modeled on after?
I think that the origin of Shylock, truthfully, is Shakespeare. That is to say, in both the sense that Shakespeare and his father lent money at interest, quietly, in their lives, but also in a deeper sense that Shakespeare understood things about what it meant to feel at edge, on edge, to be despised, to grapple with being an outsider. I think he understood this from his life. Of course, there are sources, literary sources, for Shakespeare's character, although there's not a very striking, as far as I know, there's not a very direct and striking character like Shylock. What's remarkable about Shylock, to me, is that he comes alive. There are stage Jews in the 16th century. There are also stories about Jews, Italian stories about Jews, that Shakespeare is drawing upon. But I think what is most interesting about the character is that Shakespeare, tapped into his own bloodstream and took something out of himself and put it into that character.
We'll go to our callers. Let me begin with you, Ahmed. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to make two quick comments about some things that were mentioned regarding the faith from a Muslim perspective regarding the Adam and Eve story. So first of all, I mean, in the whole of the Quran, there is no mention of any serpent or anything like that. It just mentions that, you know, the devil basically deceives both Adam and Eve. It always says both Adam and Eve. It does not, implicate Eve in any case, that she was the only one who was the instigator of the whole problem. So it's on both of them in the whole of the story in the Quran.
You're right, Ahmed. That's one of the remarkable features of, I think, of the Quranic tradition, Islamic tradition, is precisely that it doesn't have a current of misogyny focused on Eve, that it sees both Adam and Eve as implicated insofar as implicated together, but also it sees Adam as an anticipation of the prophet. Adam is having one of the figures in the Quran with a prophetic vocation. And so far from focusing on the wickedness as the principal inheritance, as it were, from the first humans, it focuses, I think, on the prophetic power of Adam. And then it's also true, as you suggest, that in the Islamic tradition, the focus is on Iblis, the equivalent of Satan, and not on the serpent as the source of the disaster.
And let me thank you for the call. Now, we'll go to more calls in just a moment, but I had alluded before to this Italian nun from the 12th century. I'd like our listeners to find out more about her from you, Arcangela Tarnabotti. I love that name.
Arcangela Tarnabotti is an astonishing person, and she was basically forced into her convent. She was lame, as her father was lame. But the parents felt that whatever the disability that she had was going to make it difficult for her to find a husband, to be good on the marriage market. And they basically pressured her into entering the nunnery, and she hated being there. Remarkably, she turned to writing, and she found actually ways of getting her work out of the nunnery and getting it in print, which is extraordinary, though the work was subsequently condemned by the Inquisition and banned. But the work was precisely about the vehement opposition to the misogynistic tradition that blamed Eve for human failings, and said, look, the failings are back on the men, not on the women. And the idea that we should be lamenting our guilt is a profound misunderstanding of the Adam and Eve story and a profound misunderstanding of our lives. She's a remarkable, unusually brave hero of the 17th century.
And here's a question right on point from Tom, who wants to know, in many ancient cultures, the mythology exists of the defiled nature of menstrual blood. Is there any connection between that anthropological origin of misogyny and the Adam and Eve story in Christian mythology?
Oh, that's interesting. There is, of course, in all through the Middle Ages, not only in Christianity, and indeed it goes back into pagan life as well, lots of anxiety about menstrual blood. But the idea of menstrual blood is not, as far as I know, part of the Eden story, because actually Adam and Eve, the notion that Eve had menstrual cycles is not, as far as I know, ever discussed in their paradisal state. What is discussed is what kind of sex they might have had, what kind of reproduction they were intended for. Because we didn't say this before, Michael, but in chapter 1 of Genesis, before the story about the naked man and woman and the talking snake, there's a different account of human origins that talks about God creating the first human in his image and likeness, and then it says male and female created he them. And many of the early interpreters said that the original human must have been a hermaphrodite. So there's a quite different account of what our sexual being was at the beginning of time.
And we'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Hugh. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a non-religious person. I've always loved the story of Adam and Eve. And I have a question that might be kind of a stupid question, but I've always wondered how do religious people explain or think about the apparent contradiction in the story where God gives Adam and Eve this instruction not to eat from the tree and then leaves and returns and is surprised by what he finds that they have eaten, and he's angry. And it's always seemed odd to me. Doesn't he know, since he's the omnipotent God, doesn't he know what they're going to do, and hasn't he set them up to fail?
Well, you have touched upon a deep problem, a deep question that, as you probably anticipate, has engaged hundreds, even thousands of people for a very long time. The God in the Hebrew Bible has many such moments in which he regrets, as he does in the case of the Noah story, regrets creating humans in the first place, or he has a moment, as you may remember, in the Genesis account of the creation, in which he says, it isn't good for the human to be alone. Well, couldn't he have thought of that in the first place? It seems to be a second thought, as it were, an afterthought, and then he creates...
Just like the rib was maybe an afterthought.
Yeah, it creates the woman subsequently, and there are many such moments, and there are a number of different ways in which this has been explained. There is, of course, if your commitment is to try to save God's omniscience and omnipotence, then you say that, of course, this is just the Bible trying to make this clear to humans, but this wasn't the way in which it actually happened. But you could also say that the Bible records a sense of the divine that's like a lot of cultures' sense of the divine, where the God actually does have second thoughts. The God in the Hebrew Bible walks in the garden in the afternoon to get some air, as if he's been cooped up for a bit and needs to have a pleasant walk in the garden, and so forth and so on. Lots of moments in which the God appears to have our own needs, desires, longings.
The best powerful story that comes to mind, you mentioned the Hebraic story of Abraham and Isaac being at the center. I mean, why would God ask a man to sacrifice his son? It's a question that, again, is really...
Well, that's an interesting instance, and it also connects to the question that was just asked. Look, these stories are meaningful not because they're transparent and simple, but because they actually ask a lot of us to try to figure out how they could possibly mean what they appear to mean. And that sense that we have to grapple with them, and this is not, as your caller suggests, this is not only something for believers. This is something that we experience in literature as well. I mean, we experience if we read a story by Kafka, if we read a novel by Henry James, if we read a poem by Ted Hughes, we actually have to grapple with difficult questions. That's why we love these things.
That's why we love literature. The grappling. And here's Rebecca as our next caller. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi. So my name is Rebecca Stern. I'm one of the rabbis at Congregation Bethel in Berkeley. And going back to the discussion about the misogyny of this story and about where Adam was, the Hebrew is actually very clear about where Adam was. He was right there with them the whole time. He just doesn't say anything. The text says that she eats of the fruit. That's true. She eats first, but she eats it first, and then she hands it, the text says, to her man who was with her. And so all of these later questions about where was he, and maybe he was taking a nap, and she had to go elsewhere to give it to him, just ignore the reality of the original text, which that little bit, those little words were just left off in translation. And we get a whole, couple thousand years of amazing misogynistic literature about Eve when Adam was right there as he's the first bystander.
Yeah, Rebecca, I thank you for that because I'm looking actually at a comment from a listener named Jonathan, which dovetails. He says, the Bible says that Adam was with Eve when she was talking with the snake and when she ate the apple. No. Why not mention this? Adam gets no blame?
It doesn't say that he was with her. It says he was there, of course, when he took the fruit from her. But the speculations that I was referring to come from the Midrash Rabbah. They don't come from the Breshit Rabbah. They don't come from 20th century or even medieval bafflement. They come from ancient bafflement. And it's a bafflement that is trying to sort of sort out how the event could have happened. But I think you're right, Rebecca, that there is a very strong reason in the tradition itself to believe that, and there were many people both in the Jewish and in the Christian tradition who thought, as Ahmed says as well, for the Islamic tradition, that Adam and Eve are equally involved, equally culpable, and that it grows out of their commitment together. But the notion that they were both present at the moment that the serpent spoke to the woman, that isn't, I beg to differ, entirely clear from the text, the Hebrew text. What is clear is that they're deeply connected, because Adam says in that remarkable moment when he's given the woman, he says, this one, Zot, this one, he repeats in Hebrew, as if he has found his mate.
Soulmate.
Soulmate.
As they like to say. Let me thank Rebecca for that call and go to a tweet from a listener named Michelle who says, where does Lilith fit into the Adam and Eve myth?
Well, Lilith isn't in the in the book of Genesis at all. It's an ancient, it's part of this strange interpretive surround of the story. It's an ancient story, but it's an attempt to explain female disobedience or the possibility of female disobedience. There are at least two stories of God having tried and failed a first time to create a female. There's one rabbinical story having to do with God creating the woman without making Adam sleep, and then Adam is nauseated by seeing what is actually inside another human being, seeing her viscera, seeing her, and then God has to set that aside and make a second attempt. And then there's a story about Lilith.
I think the word in the Bible is kishkas, isn't it?
I think that is the technical term. And then there's a second account in which, but these are not biblical accounts, a second speculation that God created a woman who refused to be subordinate to the man, who under tremendous pressure, including the most profound threats, refused to do what she was told to do and therefore was punished, and indeed was punished through her offspring as well, though she's created many demons and so forth. And Lilith is in folklore associated with infant mortality, with lots of human woes.
A lot of that's in Yiddish folklore. It's in Isaac by Sheva Singer, for example.
Yeah, I mean, of course, these are long currents, and Singer was in touch with the long folkloric currents in Judaism, and there are comparable ones in Christianity. People wanted to know more about the story, about who these characters were. The scriptural story is extremely brief. And it invited, in effect, elaboration from ancient times on.
Shows people, those fiction writers, are you listening? Keep your story short sometimes. You get the interpretation value of it from your readers. We're speaking with Harvard University Humanities Professor Stephen Greenblatt. His new book is The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. And let me get another caller on, and that's you. David, welcome.
Yes. As a scientist, I'm listening to all this, and I need to check a couple of facts, especially about St. Augustine. You know, everybody talks about him and the original sin concept and how he goes right back to Eve. Well, let's talk about him when his before he became so-called St. Augustine. Well, first of all, he was a misogynist. He couldn't get along with any woman whatsoever. They were disgusted by him, and he found that very frustrating.
Did you read this into the Confessions?
David, I don't recognize the person you're describing.
Yeah, neither do I.
He lived for 13 years very happily with his mistress, with whom he had a child, the little boy named Adeodatus, and he says that he loved that woman, and presumably she loved him. So I'm not sure I recognize this account.
I was going to say, this is what you mentioned. He's reading the Confessions. Is this where you found this, David?
It was pointed out. I believe I'm really not sure the source from whence this came from. It was something like the Book of Miracles, or I'm not sure exactly how that was explained. But St. Augustine, I was told, who was put into the Bible, the original sin concept. Is that not correct?
Yes, he was the principal person, not unique, but the principal person behind this notion that we bear from the transgression in the Bible. We all bear this original sin. This is not fundamentally an idea in the rabbinical sources, nor is it in Islam.
No, I believe it's from the New Testament.
Well, it's from St. Augustine, it's true. It's from
St. Augustine, yeah. Right.
Well, let me actually, David, thank you, because I want to go on to a tweet here that says, I'm tired of hearing this. Matthew, people blame Augustine for older ideas. Read Greek and Syriac writers, too. I mean, getting this defense of Augustine and also attacks of Augustine. He still gets that polarization.
It's certainly true that I don't think, again, against what David just said, I don't think blaming Augustine for misogyny is actually the right way to go. I don't think Augustine is fundamentally a misogynist. I think there are many ways you could say that Jerome is responsible for, not uniquely, but as your tweet just said, look at the story. Look at Hesiod. Look at the story of Pandora. The pagans had their own incredibly strong currents of misogyny, and early Christianity actually was unusual in having a place at the table for women.
At Hecuba. Look at Medea. There's a great deal of misogyny in Greek mythology, as you said. But here's Teresa says, don't blame Eve. Casting Eve as the villain of the fall is like shifting the blame for the crucifixion from Pilate to the Jews.
Well, that's very good, because it is centrally the case, and that's what's pleasurable about this whole fascinating story, that it is possible to, within it, to take and very, very different views as to what's happened here. And that is true all the way back, as far as we can go.
This is a little bit off subject, maybe, but a listener wants to know your take on the movie Mother with Ed Harris and Michelle Pfeiffer playing a modern Adam and Eve. Did you see it?
I have not, but it's been suggested to me by several of my students, so I will actually see it.
And we'll bring another caller on. Raya, hi, you're on the air. Raya or Raya?
Raya,
yeah. Okay, I got it right the first time.
Hi.
Yeah, hi.
That's okay. Hi, good morning. You know, from think back to my Western civilization class back in the day, I learned that I guess we all kind of spawned from the same area, from the Fertile Crescent area. I was wondering, how does the Judeo-Christian version of creation compare to the Hindu version of creation, since we're all in the same area at one point?
I don't have a very good answer to that, mainly because in my sense of things, but I could be corrected, there are multiple versions of creation stories in South Asia, not a single one. There's, in other words, not a Hindu doctrine, of, as far as
no,
I know.
But the Bhagavad Gita is the main one.
But there isn't a creation of the first humans in that account, I don't think. What is fascinating, Raya, is, to me at least fascinating, is that the Adam and Eve story intuited, in effect, and it's by no means a universal idea about the human beings, they intuited something like the equivalent to our notion of scientific notion of mitochondrial Eve. That is to say that there must have been an original source for all humans, because there's, of course, alternative theories, which is that there are many sources for human life, many different accounts. As far as we know, virtually all cultures have origin stories to tell, because human beings want to know something about where they come from. And it is absolutely true in China, in India, in North America, that there are multiple and competing accounts of our origins. This particular story happens to have a force for us because of the enormous dominant force of the three great monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. One of the things that's powerful about South Asian stories, including the Bhagavad Gita, is that notion of a single monotheistic, unique God gives way to a very different account, as in the Greek and Roman world, of multiple gods. And then we're in a totally different universe in which we don't actually trace everything back to a single creator of everything.
I remember having an author on who said that polytheism was much less filled with aggression and combativeness and so forth. I mean, though the stories would belie that, but that there was within the world of the polytheistic world much less of that until you had that Old Testament God who was full of all kinds of rancor and enmity and vengeance will be mine and all the rest. At least he was trying to sort of flog that thesis.
As you said in a parenthesis just now, Michael, we look around the world as actually, how should we say, more than enough aggression to go around just about everywhere.
Well, I wonder about things to go around. Prompts me to ask you about, I mean, it's clear why Augustine figures so importantly and preeminently in your book, along with Voltaire, and along with Milton, but also you do get into Voltaire and you get into the Mormons and ultimately even Twain. How did you go about selecting, because there's so many who have actually gone into the Adam and Eve story?
I mean, what interested me about Voltaire, about Pierre Bayle, and about Mark Twain is what happens starting really in the 17th century, when more and more voices are raised saying, look, there's something significantly wrong with this story, and we shouldn't believe that this is our literal origin story. And those are a selection of voices of particular power, I think, of calling into question the legitimacy of a literal interpretation of the story. We in the 21st century are the inheritors of the story, but we're also the inheritors of an Enlightenment critique of the story. I mentioned the Mormon interpretation because the Mormons are actually a very interesting and I think quite vivid version of a continued belief in the possibility of a literal interpretation of the story. But the Mormons locate the original paradise in the New World. And there were many other versions of this, trying to find where the actual place was. The Mormons are fascinating because they're so recent and current and have a stake in possibly finding the place itself in our own world, in this case in what is now the United States.
Again, our guest is Stephen Greenblatt. Read some comments here. Before I do, though, I have to ask you, as our preeminent Shakespeare scholar, what do you think about calling the Shakespearean field pre-modern now? That's taken over. And it's no more Elizabethan or Shakespearean. It's mostly pre-modern.
Yes, yeah, a funny term. We want to situate ourselves somehow in relation to the past, as if everything depends on how far or close it is to whatever we mean by modern. I mean, from my perspective, Shakespeare really lived late last night. So it's not difficult to think of him as very close to us, as he is close to us. My son was born in 2000. My youngest son was born in 2001. My father was born in 1897. That's three centuries. And we just go back a couple more connections of that kind, and we're back in Shakespeare's world. It's not that far away. So in that sense, I would rather say he's modern, rather, not pre-modern. Or if we want to locate him in a particular time and place, we could say, yes, he's lived in Elizabethan and Jacobean England. I think that we can push him back or have him close to us depending on what we want from him.
Do you still lock horns at all with Harold Bloom?
Lock horns. He was my teacher a million years ago, and I...
Then there was an Oedipal revolt. We actually talked about it.
Yeah, I greatly admire him, but I'm not sure that the... we have many disagreements, but the disagreements, as it were, within the family.
Well, this hour's gone very swiftly, as I knew it would. I didn't even get to some of these comments, actually questions and everything. I'm sorry about that to listeners and a lot of callers that would have liked to have joined in. But you can continue putting your comments online simply by going to kqed.org. Again, Stephen Greenblatt, our guest this hour, author of The Rise and Fall of Adam and Eve. His other books include the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Swerve, How the World Became Modern, and also he's the author of Will in the World. And so good to have you back with us on Forum.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. We'll be back on tomorrow. We're going to talk to Kristen Scott Thomas in the opening hour tomorrow. Stay tuned or be there with us for that. Thank you for being a part of this today. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.